You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Kids tend to know whether they like or dislike a particular food pretty soon and often let us know quite dramatically. For the rest of us, determining whether we prefer one thing over another may not be as cut and dried. We rarely have a clue as to why we love certain things and absolutely hate others. But now psychologists and other scientists are dreaming up experiments to explain our preferences, and Tom Vanderbilt covers this in an article called Accounting for Taste in the June issue of Smithsonian. Mr. Vanderbilt has written three books, including Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do. He's currently at work on another about the science behind our preferences, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hello.
Hello. Always a pleasure.
Do people tend to be more emphatic about what they like or what they dislike?
Probably depends who you ask, but I think it depends what context you're doing. And if you're asking people to rate things, I think we have a positivity bias and there's a certain self-selection going on there. For example, to think of something besides food, looking at the website, Netflix, for example, where you're asked to rate a film, you're going to tend to get, if you like something, people are going to want to vote for that more than a dislike going on. There's basically more positive voting that happens.
Although the internet seems to have encouraged people who want to say negative things to open up to the rest of the world. But that's a whole other issue.
It has made everyone a critic.
And it's actually it does affect food because if you look at Yelp reviews, often the reviews reveal more about the person who is writing it than about the restaurant they're talking about.
Yeah, and I actually just wrote another piece about Yelp, and as someone who's very confused and about dealing with trying to find a place to eat, and often you'll see a one-star review, and you have to read through the entire review to find out what their criteria was for that. And often it's something very minor. There was too much sunlight streaming through the window. It has nothing to do with the food at all. So,
well, how firm are we in what we like or dislike? Can you tell us about how people have been duped into liking white wine or smoked salmon ice cream?
Yeah, our tastes are incredibly unstable, which is ironic given the number of times a day I think we are audibly expressing our taste to someone at a restaurant or I don't like this, I don't like that. But, I mean, there's any number of factors going on here as well. You mentioned, when people were told a food was sort of a frozen, I think it was a frozen savory mousse versus a pâté, you know, it affected how they liked it. You know, sort of expectation. Exposure, how often we've been exposed to something.
A frozen mousse with salmon would be much more appealing than salmon, smoked salmon ice cream, even though it's the same thing.
Yes, yes.
And you also said that people who said they didn't like white wine were perfectly happy when they were given white wine with red dye in it.
And even their whole language about how they talked about it changed and it became more floral, less sort of tannic. It's a little bit dispiriting in a way how unstable these tastes are and how susceptible to manipulation they are.
And you even learned that the order of the foods that we consume matters in our perceptions of them.
Yeah, this is one thing that people in the food industry has used for years, taste panels based on these hedonic characteristics, and they've come up with a 9-point ranking scale. And just trying to ask people how they think about something is very fraught science, and mathematically, and then also just in a sort of, you know, qualitative way. And the science is still emerging, and those panels are not often as robust as you would like. But it's a huge enterprise. I traveled in the article, for example, to Natick, which is Department of Defense's Soldier Systems Service Center, where you will find what's called the Combat Feeding Directorate. And a surprising amount of our contemporary food industry research actually comes from Natick, which surprised me. But they were trying to do all this research in the post-World War II era because troop morale had sort of reached a point with the food they were given, these sort of K rations, how to make people feel better about it. So they launched on this huge enterprise, you know, essentially around the question, what do people like? Why do they like it? How does it change?
Well, they have problems in that they have to prepare foods that can remain fresh for a long time because then that can be prepared on the battlefield.
Yes, and the problem is the soldiers know that they can sit around in a warehouse for 3 years. And literally we're talking things like salmon that you can open in 3 years from now thanks to some new technologies. And
they call them MREs?
Yes, not meals ready to exit, as some soldiers call them, but meals ready to eat. And there's a current and of course, troop food has been going back for centuries. The current thermal stabilization processes actually date from a Nicolas Appert's work for Napoleon's army. Civil War, there was something called desecrated vegetables, which was a dried vegetable disc that you put in hot water to make a tea. But the point is, you know, what they found there is a number of interesting things. You know, sort of expectation plays a huge part in it. So if you're given something that looks like a K-ration or just looks strange, not a food sort of substance that is, you know, a little wonder pill or something, people will not like it as much if you give it to them in, say, a package that they're familiar with. So the Army has done a lot of work to try to bring Pop-Tarts, for example, as Pop-Tarts into the battlefield, not as brown-wrapped, you know, sort of anonymous toaster pastries, because they're used to that.
So if you wrap corn, for example, put it in a green giant can, they're more likely to eat it than if you just put it in some plain can.
Yes, they will eat more of it, and they will report liking it more, which is, you know, good news for Green Giant. But
well, how much of this then has to do with visual appeal? Because so many of these things are not attractive looking, even if they taste okay.
Yeah, there's a kind of a neophobia that goes on. All of us are a little bit resistant to new food, and especially unfamiliar food. Because familiarity is a huge aspect here. And Natick actually did some interesting experiments where they had soldiers eat in the dark, which is a not uncommon experience in a combat situation. And quite apart from liking, they found that people actually had trouble understanding what they were eating. If they were told it was strawberry and it was actually apple, they actually were quite easy to fool them. So our eyes, I think there's some cliche about our eyes, taste begins with our eyes and later our stomach, but
well, there have been all these other tests in which they've given people inexpensive wines and told them they were expensive, and given them expensive wines and told them they were inexpensive, and they preferred the ones that they thought were expensive.
Yeah, the sort of gustatory appeal at a basic level is important, but it is surrounded by this whole raft of other things. If you've seen the film Sideways, the scene where Miles is sort of drinking this treasured 61 Cheval Blanc, and he drinks it in a fast food place with onion rings, and he's in a styrofoam or paper cup, and you know the wine should be as good as if you were drinking it in a glass in a fancy restaurant, but of course we all know that it probably isn't. The experience is lessened by all these contextual factors, and all those things have been found to diminish or increase liking. Strange things, if you eat, you know, Indian food, people found that they liked it more if you played Indian music while they were eating it rather than, you know, the Eagles or something.
Well, if you play the Eagles, I'm not going to like the meal no matter where I'm eating. But no, that's unfair. I was just making a joke. Tom Vanderbilt has written an article for Smithsonian. Actually, this is probably part of the book that you're working on.
Yes. Oh, that's not exclusively about food, but yes.
And the article is called Accounting for Taste. It's in the June issue. By the way, we have a link to the article on our show page at WNYC.org if you'd like to read it. You would think that food companies have figured out by now how to make people buy things just by adding more salt, sugar, or fat. But that's not true. They still have problems.
Well, as Mitchell Moss's book points out, those are huge drivers. But even within those categories, you're never quite sure what's going to hit or not in a
because
sort of
products fail. I've always wondered about Pepsi-Cola Crystal. It came out with big fanfare, and then it just died. They must have done some testing on it.
Yeah, and this is another thing where the testing ahead of time often doesn't predict what will actually happen in the marketplace. Clearly, for that product to to enter the marketplace, it had been vetted along the way, and people had reported liking it. This, by way of reminding the listener, was a clear cola drink that was, and again, this violated people's expectations. You've grown up drinking dark cola all your life. Suddenly, you're given this clear thing, and it has this odd taste. And I think there was an issue there. They tried to price it higher and treat it as a premium product, which can also increase liking. But again, none of these things are 100% certain, which is why I think only something like 12 to 15% of new products that are introduced in supermarkets succeed. The rest fail and are gone the next season.
We're going to take a little break. We'll come back, talk more about why we like what we like and why we don't like what we don't like and why it varies even within the same family. My guest is Tom Vanderbilt. Stay with us for more. We're back with Tom Vanderbilt, whose article Accounting for Taste is in the June issue of Smithsonian Magazine. You began your piece with the story of the makers of Vlasic pickles being concerned about losing out to their leading competitor, Clausen, and the experiment that Howard Moskowitz, a Harvard-trained psychophysicist and food industry consultant, conducted. What kind of results did they get?
Yeah, I think they were looking for, you know, they were having some pickle competition, and they broke, they really broke it down, this mathematical analytical process, and broke the pickles down into different treatments, treatments that were, you know, much spicier than had ever been attempted before, just trying to open up the windows of their experience a little bit. And they found that, to their surprise, you know, people actually seemed to like these spicy pickles more than they had expected, and went on to launch this new kind of categorization. With, there's a thermometer scale on the pickle jar now. And he's done other work that Malcolm Gladwell has talked about with ketchup. And just, you know, this is another way. So again, the food industry doesn't always know what – it reminds me of, you know, Anthony Goldman's comment about Hollywood, no one knows anything. The food industry sometimes has the same problem.
Well, they I guess they were afraid to do something that would push the envelope. But we're caught in a bind, isn't it? Is it a matter of whether something is foreign to us or not that determines whether we like it or we're willing to try it? Otherwise, we would be eating pablum and strained peaches all of our lives, wouldn't we?
Absolutely. I mean, there's this concept, again, of neophobia, where we fear the unknown, which probably dates back to some evolutionary story about things that may kill us, we do not want to eat. And that's why, even to this day, we all have an inherent liking for sweetness, but we don't have an inherent liking of bitter. We distrust bitter because bitter is associated with poison, toxicity. And you then sort of wonder, well, how do you make that transition from liking a bitter substance to disliking to liking? I'm drinking this cup of coffee right now. I remember distinctly my first time I had coffee. I was a teenager driving across country. I drank it because I was trying to stay awake. I knew it had these magical powers. I really did not like the taste. I loaded it down with milk and sugar, which is what people do. They put in these things that we are known to like. And over time, just through a number of exposures, and psychologists call it mirror exposure, just, and this is the trick that as a parent you're always trying to do, just give your child more exposure. So, so it sort of hinges on this thing. Do we know what we like, or do we like what we know? And I think it's often the latter.
And then we hear that there are certain things that people like or don't like. Kids are supposed to not like spinach, and yet a lot of kids do like spinach. I wondered whether I should like spinach when I was a kid.
From what I understand, there are very few innate aversions to food. There's some evidence of a cilantro dislike, people report it tastes soapy. A lot of those people even come to like it.
But there are different kinds of foods in different cultures. For example, fermented tofu is something that may be very popular within the Chinese community, but a lot of non-Chinese people find very hard to take. You can develop a taste for it. Chipotle is another example. It was not even known in outside of Mexico for many years, and now it's a very popular taste. So we've crossed the line with that.
It's a very popular flavor, and there's a distinction to be made there because taste is really one of these five things: sweet, savory, bitter, umami. But it was how those tastes come together in flavors that tells us the story. And if we had these biological biologically innate taste, as you suggest, you know, sushi, we wouldn't be consuming sushi. I mean, sushi is kind of an unusual food in the American tradition if you think about it, but it's now one of our favorites.
Well, there was a long-term resistance, and then it became a favorite. So what happened? People suddenly got past the idea that raw fish was something they weren't going to like?
Yeah, I think it's almost a societal version, again, of that individual exposure dynamic going on. You begin to see it more. Your friends start eating it. Soon you're eating it. And you might start with sort of the California roll, only kind of touch the safe stuff, and that kind of provides an entry point. And this is what with Chipotle, I talk to people at McCormick, the spice company, because, you know, they're always trying to expand their market and introduce new flavors into the American market. And with Chipotle, things like Chipotle, you know, they do this thing where they sort of pair the unfamiliar with the familiar. So you might do a Chipotle chicken wing. And you know, people, there's nothing inherently dislikable about Chipotle. It was just, again, that unfamiliarity.
Well, Mexicans are surprised that Americans like Chipotle so much. It's just part of the general arsenal that they use when they're cooking. Is our taste for food and drink similar or different from the way we approach music or art?
I think there's some very similar processes going on there, exposure, categorization. The neuroscientist I was talking to at Yale, Dana Small, actually was looking at a colleague's computer one day by mistake instead of her own research, and it was some neurological work about liking for food. It kind of looked like some results she was looking at for chocolate, except it was her colleague's study, which was actually about music. So some of the same reward pathways, I think. I mean, music doesn't – food has things, you know, like post-ingestive consequences when you get a nice sugar hit from something you've eaten. I mean, I don't think – obviously music doesn't have that, but neurologically there seems to be some of the same processes going on.
You tell a story about meeting a woman named Deborah Zellner, a professor of psychology at Montclair State University, for lunch, and she questioned the whole notion of liking something that you choose to eat. You look at a menu and you decide that you'd probably like this dish the best, but you haven't tasted it.
No, I mean, eating at a restaurant is sort of a fraught experience. There's so much going on. There's the expectation of what you're going to eat. Does it live up to that expectation? I mean, if you're told about a restaurant that's supposed to be amazing and you eat there, are you liking it the same as if you had heard nothing about the restaurant? You know, then you're looking at a menu. You say something like, it sounds good. Well, that's sort of an interesting phrase. Why does it sound good? And sometimes it literally sounds good. John Allen has done some work talking about onomatopoeia in food and things like even the word crispy. Crispy sounds like what it is, and it sounds sort of innately appealing. Mario Batali says he can sell more food objects just by putting the word crispy in the the menu is an interesting, you know, driver of liking as well.
And then we have a caller who says she worked as a dietitian with a blind woman. The woman couldn't tell the difference in taste of food, so she's assuming that sight informs our taste buds. I mean, I can't believe that you can't tell the difference between a beef and a piece of trout.
You'd be surprised. I mean, we know that obviously nasal, the nose is hugely implicated in taste, but again, that taste is sort of separate. Being able to taste something is then different from the liking process, which I think, you know, as someone described it, liking is learning. I mean, we talk about acquired tastes, but it's really sort of, you know, acquired liking is, you know.
And then you say there's a kind of tragic irony when it comes to enjoying food, that as we eat something, we begin to like it less.
Yes, there's an interesting phenomenon called sensory-specific satiety, say that five times quickly, that I've done all sorts of studies that, you know, the more you eat of one thing, you begin to get sort of full, and your liking for that diminishes. It sort of diminishes the minute you begin eating it. And it's been shown if you give people sort of candies, give them only one color of a candy, their liking begins to diminish. Give them a different color of the same candy, and they like that suddenly again. It's just, again, that little visual novelty again.
And then you report that if you ask people whether they, you know, on a certain scale, whether they like a food or more or less, whether they dislike a food more or less, after they've eaten it, the food that they had given a higher rating to gets a slightly lower rating, and the food that they'd given a lower rating to gets a higher rating.
Yeah, that was research that was done again at Natick, and they, you know, I think they were talking about things like lasagna, and then they went back and asked people, and our memory, I think our liking is driven not only by anticipation, but then the memory. What was the memory of the last time you had that particular dish? And again, yeah, it sort of suggests that we don't like what we like quite as much as we think we do, and we don't dislike what we dislike as much as we think we do.
A caller reports that her 3-year-old will not eat fresh fruit. She'll eat dry fruit, but never fresh fruit, regardless of the type. Is that common in children? I mean, children make these decisions despite the fact that they're offered the fresh fruit and the dry fruit.
I have no idea about that particular thing. But with children, I have a 4-year-old. I mean, we know that there are some inherited tastes that were developed in the womb, and many studies have shown that. A mother that eats garlic there might be a slight preference for garlic. That's the familiarity exposure effect right there.
But garlic actually winds up going to the child, to the fetus.
Another thing, a lesson that I've learned and I've read some research about is that, you know, you should not reward children for eating a certain food because they will begin to it gives them sort of less implicit motivation to actually eat that food for its own virtues. And they're, you know, kind of thinking of this extrinsic innovation. It's been shown not to work as well as curiously, it seems to work better if you give them a non-food reward for eating that. Don't give them ice cream. Give them a toy. But
how much do we learn from putting people through MRIs while they're eating?
That's not something I've looked that much into, but other people, it gets into this classic debate with psychologists. I mean, do you learn anything more than simply by observing people's behavior? And do you learn more about the liking process? I mean, I think you probably do, but again, not something I've looked that much into.
Well, in researching this book and the book that you're writing about taste, and you say that it's more than about food, but has it affected you and the way you think about your own tastes?
Yes, I mean, I'm not sure I can fully answer that at this point, but it's something that something I'm definitely attuned to. And just the word liking and disliking in this internet age, our Facebook pages, we like things, we give a thumbs up like, and I'm sort of curious about these processes. What does it actually mean?
Well, you asked me when you came in here whether there are certain foods that I don't like or that I do like. Well, I like most foods, but there are some that I don't like, and I have reasons for them, but they are not necessarily, they're more psychological. Like my mother made something in a way that sweet potatoes in a way that I didn't like, and so I've always had a disliking of sweet potatoes, even though I've eaten many sweet potatoes and been perfectly happy eating them.
Yeah, I think these are often, our liking processes are stories we're telling ourselves that would not hold up to any sort of real scrutiny if we were sort of forced to eat that food. Although the one exception there is there are food aversions that develop when you have a nauseous reaction to something. That can actually instigate a kind of deep-seated continuing dislike for many college students and involve some sort of sweet liquor perhaps that they may have imbibed too much of. But
Now, just one more thing. Okay, you've had a fabulous meal, and now the waiter comes over with the dessert menu, and you really are full. But more often than not, people will still order a dessert. Why?
Again, it's been sort of referred to as the dessert effect, but it taps into that sensory-specific satiety. Again, you wouldn't want to eat another meat course, another potato course, but suddenly here's this different thing, novelty. And there's some argument also that you're eating the dessert as you're sort of starting to enjoy those post-ingestive consequences of the real nutritive food that you've eaten. So I sort of wonder, you know, if dessert is fooling us a bit, if it, part of the reason it seems so great is because we're have this kind of high we're on from the actual meal, and perhaps we should eat dessert first before the meal begins too.
Well, one of the hot fads in New York restaurants right now is tasting menus, where you get a little dish of this and then a little dish of that and a little dish of something else. Does that actually get us past this whole matter of three or four bites and we stop liking it as much?
Yeah, I think it's a good strategy, and it will probably enhance liking for each of those small dishes, and it will probably also increase consumption. There's been studies that, again, show that things like a buffet style, people will make more trips to that based on the variety versus if you gave them one food. And this was shown again at Natick. If you give soldiers just the same ration every day, a monotony begins to develop, and they will actually consume less, even if they really want to. I mean, weight loss becomes a real consequence with troops. I mean, this is part why they've invested so much time and effort up there, because not only morale but performance of troops, and food is just as important as ammunition or fuel or any other kind of commodity for soldiers. So
there's also one other factor, and that is our philosophy of life. It's the reason why there are vegetarians and vegans who will not eat meat, even if they perhaps like the taste of it before they became vegetarians.
Yeah, I think there are bottom-up processes that happen and top-down where, as sugar, salt, fat, we all love, but you can develop a knowledge and you develop an outside, you know. But, and those are pretty flexible, though. I mean, when people start to be served. There was an experiment. They gave people soup and started lowering the salt with each successive portion. After only four exposures, as the salt was dropping, people then began to decrease their liking for salt. So, you know, we've gone the other way in the American food system, where we're salting everything up. So we've kind of ratcheted the bar up for salt and sugar. And it depends what your normal sort of course of eating is as well. I mean, just to pick on a food chain, Obon Pan, for example, I have gotten a bagel there before, and it's an onion bagel, and it has an overriding sweetness that this is a true New Yorker speaking here, I really can't stand. It jumps out at me, why is this savory bagel sweet? And that's the American diet right there. So it's the good news is it wouldn't be that hard to sort of shift back, but everyone has to do it at once and decrease the liking.
Tom Vanderbilt's article in the current issue of Smithsonian Magazine is called Accounting for Taste. We have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org if you'd like to read the whole thing. And Tom, thank you so much for being on our show again.
Great. Thank you.